loose cut, because this man who wore this would have been going up and down rigging. It's covered in bits of tar, so it's obviously stained, quite used. Yeah.
That was Tanya Cooper describing one of the many objects on show at the National Portrait Gallery's new exhibition.
In the public school game, it was regarded as unmanly. It was an abdication of responsibility to pass the ball. It was all about, you know, charging into the other side. It was mock battle.
And that was Richard Sanders on football 150 years ago. Also this week, we're talking to the BBC's commissioning editor for history about the corporation's First World War plans. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. See historyextra.com/subscribe-today for our latest subscription deals. And we also have digital editions available for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. For details of all of those, head to historyextra.com/digital. A new exhibition examining the lives of ordinary Tudor people has recently opened at the National Portrait Gallery in London. We sent our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, to meet the exhibition's curator, Dr. Tanya Cooper, and take a closer look at some of the remarkable objects on show.
Right, so Tanya, it's a couple of days before the exhibition opens, and you kindly invited me down to have a look at the exhibition. We're sitting in front of probably one of my favourite paintings, which is The Fate of Bermondsey. Can you perhaps just tell us a little bit about this painting and why it's so special?
Yes, it's a really, really remarkable painting for British art, because so few things like this actually exist. It's an extraordinary celebration scene on the bank of the River Thames, and you're somewhere about Bermondsey, I think, where Bermondsey is now. And you have this extraordinary array of different people, different classes of society, from serving people to extraordinarily wealthy individuals. I mean, he's in the middle here is a man in his golden cloak with a lovely hat. And then some of the brightly dressed women, which is always interesting, I think, aren't necessarily the really rich people, but are also the people, the country people. There's a lovely woman, two or three women and men, who are dancing with their red stockings on and lovely red hose. So it shows a real range of society.
And would that have been, I mean, would the sort of scene actually have taken place, do you think? Could it have happened?
It certainly could have happened. We know that there were quite a lot of fetes throughout the year in Elizabethan England, near the Thames or throughout London. Mm-hmm. What you've got is possibly a cross between a fete or a community celebration and a wedding. Right. We think it might be a wedding because on the far side, on the right side of the picture, you have coming out from probably the church entrance, as it were, a procession of people, but they're wearing rather sober clothes. Yeah. They're wearing black. But right this man, you see him here, he is carrying a golden cup with flowers and garlands coming out and streamers. And then in front of him is four people, two women and two men, who are carrying these enormous, enormous cakes. And these are described...
They're cakes, I was wondering what they were.
Huge, great cakes. And they're very, very likely bride cakes. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is the type of celebration that might have taken place at a wedding, but exactly where the bride is, I think, is another question. Historians have got all sorts of theories about that. She may have come out already and be among the party, and this may be the family who are coming in, or it may be an amalgam of a fete scene and a wedding.
I mean, there is so much to see. You can see the Tower of London in the background in the far corner. There's some musicians, and I think in your piece you wrote that perhaps the artist himself has perhaps painting himself in it.
Exactly, yeah. There's on the far right-hand side, right at the front of the picture, there are two musicians in their beautiful scarlet coats who've probably got something equivalent to a violin, but possibly a viol. And just behind them are three men who are looking out at the picture to you. There's one man sat down, all of them have got, or two of them have got caps on, one's bareheaded, and all of them are looking out directly at you, the viewer. And it's a sort of trope or a type of a format, really, for the artist to look directly out at the viewer. And I think it probably is this man just sat down here, who's saying, "Hello, I'm here, this is what I look like."
Yeah. I mean, one thing that strikes me when I look at this is that you were saying earlier about the colours of the clothes. Even the poorer people, they're wearing very bright clothes.
Exactly. And when you think about people wearing quite drab clothes,
yes,
in the Elizabethan period,
and,
but this is an absolute riot of colour. There are people wearing really bright scarlet red, this lovely peacock blue colour that this man's got on his belt, and some lovely kind of pinks and greens. And this man, or young boy really, holding a dog who's being attacked by another dog. He's wearing these great, lovely stockings, red stockings, and then a lovely blue long jacket, as it were. They look quite elaborate, but yeah. Actually some of these people would be reasonably middle class or fairly ordinary people. It wasn't black that you can see in the middle. Mm-hmm. Some of the wealthiest people really are dressed in black, and black was this colour that was quite an expensive colour to get, because it needed to be dyed again and again and again to get a really true black. So it was a kind of a status colour, really, black.
We're in the Elizabeth room, and we're sort of surrounded by various portraits of Queen Elizabeth I. And the one directly in front of us is a huge piece. It's the Hardwick Hall painting.
That's right.
And it's just it's an amazing, amazing piece. Can you just maybe just describe what we're seeing?
Yes. I mean, there are some wonderful, iconic portraits of Elizabeth I here, but this painting really dominates the room because of its size, but also because of its remarkable composition. Mm. Elizabeth is standing before us on a step which is carpeted, and she appears sort of looming above you. What she's wearing really attracts attention. Elizabeth's costumes are always rather remarkable, but this one is absolutely extraordinary. And she's wearing a huge, great farthingale, which was a great, large hoop that would allow your skirt to hang out in a circular movement, as it were. But the fabric that's covering that is covered in, probably embroidered, but possibly painted, fishes and sea creatures, sea monsters, and flowers. And you can see all sorts of extraordinary sort of sea unicorns and crabs and roses and flowers, almost sort of sea swimming dogs and extraordinary swans. There is a plethora of animals that you can't almost begin to imagine, because they are extraordinary imaginary creatures. And I think, although very little of Elizabeth I's costume survives, virtually nothing survives, it's quite likely that this was a real dress.
Oh, okay, so
this
exactly
is something
exists.
That would have existed. There's a long inventory of Elizabeth's clothes, and we know that she did have some really, really remarkable costume. Mm. So I think, although it looks bizarre and extraordinary, it probably is fairly accurate.
Yeah, and you can almost feel like you could sort of touch the dress, doesn't it? The silk and the...
It's shimmering away, isn't
it?
The satin, you just want to kind of feel the quality of it.
Yeah, and I mean, some bits of the dress I can understand. I mean, it's covered in pearls, obviously she used to show her virginity.
That's
and things
right.
like that. Mm. Why would she have had a dress with all these sort of sea monsters and things like that on it? What does that tell her?
Well, the Elizabethans are quite playful. They really love the opportunity for all sorts of extraordinary things. And we'll see some other things later in the show. Mm. But I think it's not necessarily that all of these emblems are emblems or symbols of things. Yeah. They're actually, it's just exquisitely beautiful.
Yeah, it's drama
fabric.
Of it, isn't
it's the,
it?
Yeah, it's the extraordinary sort of quality of the different fabrics that are used, because what you've got is the sheen, and probably you've got some sort of shimmering light fabric that would have gone over the top of that, so it would have moved in a different way. And as you say, the pearls, the black part of the dress is absolutely covered in rubies and pearls, and Elizabeth routinely wore three colours of red, black, gold and white, and you see all of those here and in other parts of the room too.
I love that you can see her little shoes as well.
Tiny little shoes.
Lovely little feet. Mm. And just looking around, I mean, how well known would Elizabeth have been to her people? I mean, would people have known what she looked like?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's the point of this room, really, because this portrait was commissioned by Bess of Hardwick, we think, and has been at Hardwick Hall really ever since the death of Elizabeth I. So this is a painting which would have hung in a noble household. What we're looking at in other portraits around this room, they would have hung in guild halls and in universities. Mm-hmm. But also, Elizabeth did something really, really remarkable with the help for her advisors. She encouraged everybody to return all of the currency and reissued the coinage in 1561. So you have most people lucky enough to own a few coins. Mm. would have a portrait in their pocket on the coinage of Elizabeth. So she's quite clever in that way, because she's allowing people to see her image, but at the same time putting the country on a sound economic footing by ensuring that there is no sort of dud coinage out there, as it were.
It's quite a shrewd decision in all ways, really.
Yes, it's really, because people would have seen her image, anybody who's earning money from working, because they're on the penny coins as well, the silver coinage. But in general, I would say Elizabeth is the most well-known monarch of her time, much more so than Edward, Mary, or her father, Henry VIII.
Okay, another one, certainly another favourite of mine in the exhibition, is the Elizabeth Vernon image, and that's actually in the feature as well that you've written for us. And again, this is quite a remarkable picture, isn't it?
I think this is a breathtaking picture. It's really extraordinary, both as a portrait, but also for who it represents. And the woman you can see in this painting is Elizabeth Vernon, who is Countess of Southampton. And why you know she's a Countess is that on some pillows to the right, she has her Countess's robes in red, which is lined with ermine. But it's a remarkable thing because she is shown in a private chamber, probably her dressing room, and next to her are laid out jewels and pendants and a little jewel box and then all the pins that she would need to put her costume together. So she's in the process of dressing, or possibly even undressing. And up on a curtain side, you see her ruff and some wired out jewels, and she's combing her hair in a rather sort of kind of perhaps come hither way, which is interesting, I suspect.
It's very informal, isn't it, compared to some of the other portraits?
It's incredibly informal. And Elizabeth Vernon at this period is just about to marry, or was possibly just married, the Earl of Southampton. And the Earl of Southampton is Shakespeare's only known patron, Henry Wrothesley. So there are all sorts of theories and ideas that are spun around this picture, but they sort of... what the painting is really about is a young couple who've just gotten married. So whether it's commissioned by Henry Wrothesley, I suspect it probably is, but we won't know. But you have a kind of young bride who is preparing herself for the toilet, whether just to go to bed or she's getting up in the morning. I think there's something incredibly moving about this, because you never have that sense, really, that you encounter an Elizabethan in their bedchamber.
No, not at all. And if we walk over here to one of your cabinets that have been set up, we can actually see some of the items are actually on her dressing table. Well, obviously not that may belong to her, but
We use the portrait of Elizabeth Vernon and all the wonderful pendants and pins and jewels that you can see there to put together a group of surviving Elizabethan objects. And there's some incredibly exciting things here, because these things don't really exist. Most Elizabethan jewels have been dismantled and recut and remodelled in a later period. So we've pulled together some of the things that an Elizabethan woman might have had on her dressing table. Not only her gorgeous rings, and we've got a beautiful diamond set ring here, just come to us from the Ashmolean Museum, with really, really lovely enamelled areas to it. It's one of the things that I almost most want to slip on my finger in this exhibition. What I love most of all, though, are these little Elizabethan pins.
Yeah, they look a little bit like tacks, don't they? You would put in the wall.
They do, and pins were absolutely indispensable in the Elizabethan period. Most people had what's called pin money to buy pins, because you couldn't really get dressed without pins. Yeah. Lots of costume in this period was a separate, so your sleeves might be separate from your jacket or your doublet, and they'd be pinned together. And these have come from an archaeological dig there from the Museum of London, and we've put them in a setting a little bit like you can see on Elizabeth Vernon's dressing table.
So they would sort of go out wearing, sort of being pinned together, really?
They would.
Absolutely a bit risky.
Well, the safety pin hasn't been quite invented at this period. But if we go around this side, we can look at a lovely little fashionable purse. And we featured this in the article.
A lovely little frog purse.
And it's a tiny frog-shaped purse, yes. And this is in gilt and silver thread. What you would have kept in it is probably needles and buttons and personal items for a woman, but it would have been the height of fashion to take out perhaps to the theatre or to go to see friends. And again, Elizabethans are quite playful with the things they like. They love this idea of things pretending to be other things, a trompe-l'oeil idea, and almost looks like this little frog could kind of jump off onto your lap and might cause a scream from a lady.
Beautiful, and it probably is about the size of a frog. It's tiny, isn't it?
It's terribly realistic. It's the sort of thing if you found in your drawer, you might sort of scream that a frog is there. But very, very charming. All of these things here would have regularly been given as gifts, and Elizabethan culture is a great gift-giving culture, particularly at New Year. And so there's a gorgeous golden pomander here, which opens out, and you would have had different perfumes, probably wooden balls that were soaked in different oils, sandalwood and rose. Various different clove scents, and you might wear this around your neck or possibly around your waist.
And the attention to detail in all of these, I mean, obviously these would have been the wealthier end of the spectrum, would have had these types of
absolutely goods, these two tables are set up as dressing tables of the nobility, really. I think there is something about the Elizabethan period which loves its detail. You know, there is more is more is more, you know. There isn't this
quite
idea
over the top.
A modern aesthetic that you want to pare back. The Elizabethans never feel that. They think, oh, can we add some more pattern and some more colour to this? So it's quite fun, I think.
And were the houses the same? Is that how they would have decorated the houses and things like that?
We know that most houses would have had either tapestries if you're particularly wealthy, or much more likely, if you're middle class or less wealthy, painted hangings. And these come up in every single inventory you can find. And you even find painted hangings in servants' quarters as well.
Okay.
And they would be quite colourful, decorative hangings that may be either floral devices, or they might be narrative scenes. They might be even scenes from the Bible or mythological scenes. And they would be quite kind of colourful and decorative, and they would hang over your walls pretty much for warmth, really, but also to cheer the place up.
And another one that I think probably listeners will be quite familiar with, it's been in the news quite quite recently, is this picture of three Elizabethan children, with a guinea pig and a little bird. Another astonishing picture, isn't it?
This is a really charming picture of three children, and they're aged 5, 6, and 7, two boys and a little girl, and they're holding their pets, a guinea pig, a multicoloured guinea pig, brown and white guinea pig that the girl is holding. And then the youngest boy is holding what we think is a sort of a finch, a male linnet, and you sort of worry for this little bird that he's holding, because you sort of think, is he holding it a little bit too
tight? Within an inch of its life.
It does. It does. But they're wearing really extraordinary costume, yellow silks and satins, and then of course they've also got jewellery on, and you think these poor little children are kind of covered in gold chains and pendants and various different things. So, and they're also, the two boys have got these lovely hats at the bottom with feathers on them here.
You can imagine that the children sort of insisting that their pets came along as well.
You can. Yes, you can.
And they are dressed like miniature adults, aren't they,
really?
Is that quite normal?
It's very normal, yes. After a period of time, it's unusual for this boy to be out of skirts.
That's the younger,
the 5-year-old. But yes, when you can get to a certain age, 5, 6, 7, you just are a miniature adult, and you wear exactly the same level of status clothes as your parents. What was extraordinary about the Elizabethan period is because Elizabeth reigned for over 40 years, you end up with a very, very stable economy. And the character who's absolutely the centre of that is this man here, this lovely portrait of Thomas Gresham, who is one of the most talented financiers, really, of the century, the 16th century. He manages to negotiate loans on behalf of the crown very favourably. He works between London and Antwerp, and he's enormously energetic. And he helps with the early recoinage, which is bringing all the duff money in, effectively, and ensuring that we have a pure gold and silver coinage. So he puts the country on an extraordinary stable footing, but he also does incredibly nicely for himself. You can see here that he looks rather glamorous.
Rather well turned out, isn't he?
Yes. In some ways, you would think that the black is quite a sober colour to be wearing, but it's one of the most expensive colours you can be seen in.
And quite interestingly, I mean, women also had a role to play in business, maybe slightly different role, didn't they? We're standing now in front of a picture of Joan Allen.
I think this is an incredibly beautiful, lovely portrait of a middle-class woman. She could be a merchant's wife, but we know that Joan Allen married an entrepreneur and business dealer. She's the wife, really, of an actor and star of the London stage, Edward Allen. And you see her here wearing smart black clothes and having beautiful red and brown gloves. She's also carrying a little book, which is probably a prayer book. and she's got a tall velvet hat on her head.
There's a lot of hats like that in this exhibition, aren't there?
There's a lot of hats, yes. I think it's interesting that portraits of this type of person, this kind of class of person, were being painted at this period, because portraiture really expands. And by the end of the Elizabethan period, you get people who are laughing at the idea that merchants' wives could have their portrait painted. So one play which is performed in front of Elizabeth I in 1598 comes up with this comment where it says, "Now that every citizen's wife wears a taffeta skirt and a velvet hat, she must have her picture in the parlour." So just saying, oh gosh, all these merchants' wives have got are using portraiture now, and that's really not on, because it should be kept for the nobility.
And what would her role have been? Would she have helped her husband in any way with the business side of things?
She would. We know a little bit about Joan Allen, but she wasn't literate. Letters that we have from her husband, she's been married, she's aged 22 in this picture, and she was married at 19, so she's already been married for 4 years, she's married quite young, show that the letter needed to be read out to her. So at this stage of her life, she couldn't yet read. But it's usual for merchants' wives, absolutely, to help their husband in all sorts of ways. And in fact, many of them did actually keep the books and do the accounts.
So who's this?
This is a really extraordinary man called George Gower. And I think this is a fascinating picture for this exhibition, because it tells you something about class status in this period. Because I think you're just getting to that moment when people are beginning to value skill over and above birthrights. And what this artist is showing you here in the background with this emblem is he has a scale with, on the one side, an emblem of skill, which is a pair of compasses, and on the other side, which is less heavy, is his own coat of arms. He's telling you here that my skill retains the praise of my family's honour, and that it's more important to me that I'm this clever artist than where I've come from. And it's a rather radical statement in the Elizabethan period, to say, you know, it's more important that what you can do. It's the beginning, almost, I suppose, of a meritocracy. I think that's what's interesting about this show, is you're having these individuals that just are able to stand up for themselves and say, actually, what I can do as a person is more important than my family background. The differential in social class really expands in the Elizabethan period. Quite a lot of people become quite a lot richer. The middle classes do reasonably well, but the poor don't do well at all, because prices have gone up so much. I mean, certainly in Elizabeth's period alone, prices over a 40-year period go up by 50%. So it becomes pretty hard for the working poor.
And I suppose it's the working poor that we don't know an awful lot about, sadly, because they wouldn't have had the money to have their portraits painted.
I would have loved to have found a portrait of a fisherman, or a portrait of an ordinary soldier in the army or navy, who was. But instead, we've got this rather extraordinary object, which is a seagoing costume, which we think was for a sailor and possibly an Elizabethan sailor. Costume historians have dated this really extraordinarily fragile object, which is mainly brown rags sewn together, to about 1590 to 1650 or so. They think it's on the earlier side of that. So it's quite possible that this is exactly what an Elizabethan sailor would look like.
It is sort of one of the stars of the exhibition,
really. It is. You encounter it right at the end of the show. And it's, I think, an incredibly moving object, really, because it's very, very loose cut, because this man who wore this would have been going up and down rigging. It's covered in bits of tar, so it's obviously
stained,
quite used. Well, why does an object like this survive, and how can we be sure it's Elizabethan? I think that's an important question for people to ask, because it was one of several studio props in the wardrobe of history painters, and there were two sets of history painters. This got used over a quite long period of time, so it's the sort of thing that's been stored away for just the right moment that would appear in a 19th century painting, and he's managed to kind of collect old clothes to allow those sorts of paintings to be recreated. But the stitches, both at the top round the collar and round the cuffs, costume historians have said have to be 17th century or late 16th century. And the clothes itself, the cloth itself, is a woven cloth, which is quite specific to that time too.
You have to look quite closely, don't you, to see it?
You really do. It's in quite low light because it's so fragile. And so few things exist like this, a costume of the working poor.
It would have been quite long. I mean, were they the quite sort of
baggy type shorts, trousers.
Yes,
how would they have been worn?
Balloon hose.
That's right.
Yeah. So that they allow lots of movement. So if you're trying to climb up and down a mast or rigging, you want to wear something like this rather than tight fitting hose because fabric at this period isn't going to stretch.
No.
There isn't a lycra, I'm afraid.
But it wouldn't have kept you very warm, I wouldn't have thought, if you were out at sea.
It probably wouldn't have kept you terribly warm, no. Imagine it's reasonably waterproof as it starts to be covered in bits of tar.
And it's quite thick as
well. It does, yeah. It does.
But isn't that something that's extraordinary?
It's the extraordinary survival, yeah. And it's, I think, a lovely way just to think about this whole body of Elizabethan people who, of course, we can't represent through portraiture.
That was Tanya Cooper on everyday life in Elizabethan England. Elizabeth I and her people is on show at the National Portrait Gallery until the 5th of January. Visit mpg.org.uk for tickets and information. If you'd like to see images of some of the pieces described in this podcast, including the Fate at Bermondsey painting and the Frog Purse, visit historyextra.com/Tudor People. You can also read a feature by Tanya in the November issue of BBC History magazine, which is out now. Also in the issue, we're considering the career of Nelson, we're taking a trip to an ancient Greek theatre, and we're questioning whether Britain needed to fight the First World War. If you like the sound of all of that, then why not pick up a copy, available in all good newsagents and digitally. 150 years ago this week, a group of representatives of some of England's football clubs met at a London tavern to form the Football Association. It was an early stepping stone in the development of what was then a fairly minor sport, but is now, of course, a global Goliath. To mark this anniversary, I interviewed football history expert Richard Sanders to find out more about the birth of the sport, and to discover how the modern game compares to the Victorian version. What exactly happened on the 26th of October 1863?
Well, what happens is around a dozen men meet at the Freemasons Tavern in London. And what they're trying to do is to, well, firstly, set up a national football association, which until that time had not existed. But more importantly, what they're trying to do is to agree a common code for football, because none existed at that time. It was different from cricket. Cricket had had the same rules for 200 or 300 years. Everyone played by the same rules. Football was an old folk game. It had been played in various parts of the country for hundreds of years. It had different rules everywhere. But crucially, in the 19th century, when it was picked up by the great public schools, each of those public schools played by different rules. And really, this initiative of the FA reflected that social class. It wasn't a gathering of the people who'd played the old popular form of what's called folk football. It was a gathering of people, most of whom, or many of whom, were drawn from the public schools. And it was an attempt to draw up a common code which all of the public schools, and this at this time, you know, means not a great deal more than half a dozen schools, which all of the public schools could agree to.
Now, you mentioned folk football, which had been played for hundreds and hundreds of years. Why was it in the 19th century that the public schools started to pick the game up, do we know?
The public schools picked the game up. There are really two parts of the process here. In the early 19th century, the public schools pick it up. Simply, it's an initiative from below. The boys start playing it. The boys have generally come to school having already played it as a folk game. And you also have to remember that public schools in the early 19th century are pretty anarchic places. There's not a lot of time actually spent in the classroom. An awful lot of the time, the boys are left to themselves, and they develop all sorts of games that they play, and football is one of them. Very simple game to play. You just simply have to have some sort of round ball and a space to play it in. So it's a very simple game to play, and it's a reflection of the huge amount of leisure time that public school boys had in the early 19th century. Now, at that time, it was rather disapproved of. The headmasters, you know, one described it as being fit only for butcher boys. It was rather looked down on. But then you have this great revolution in methods and manners in the public schools in the mid-19th century, when suddenly people are trying to impose some order on these anarchic institutions. You get the rise of the cult of muscular Christianity and the whole cult of athleticism. Suddenly headmasters decide games are actually a rather good idea. They keep the boys out of mischief. And they're good for forcing the boys to organise themselves. And above all, they're seen as character forming. And so from around the 1840s, football is actually encouraged in the public schools.
What was the relationship at this point between what we now know as football and rugby? Because that would also be being developed this time, is that right?
Yeah. Now, so the key thing to understand here is you essentially have seven great public schools, six of them, of which Eton and Harrow are the best known, but also Winchester, Shrewsbury, Westminster and so on. Six of them play what we would regard as football. Okay, one of them, rugby, plays what we now know as rugby. Now, the difference there is not necessarily handling. In pretty much all of the forms of football, you could handle the ball. The difference was that at rugby, you could run while holding the ball, something which seems to have evolved in the first half of the 19th century. So that was the great fault line within the public schools, that the six that played football, the where the kicking game predominated, all played different games, but they were closer together. Rugby played a separate game.
We're talking here about the sort of the upper class, how they are playing football. What was going on at this point, 1863, say, in the wider world? Were working middle class people, were they playing any form of football at this time?
This is the interesting point when you look into it. The traditional historiography of football basically gives all the credit to developing modern football to the public schools. The idea is that traditional folk football was sort of an anarchic, a wild village romp, which had effectively died out, like so many other popular pastimes, with the Industrial Revolution, with the enclosure movement, with the growth of towns, etc., etc. Now, modern research shows that actually, although it had certainly declined dramatically, old folk football survived a lot more than people thought, and also wasn't quite as wild and anarchic as people have always thought. There was much more skill to it than people thought. So this idea that basically folk football dies and modern football is descended from public school football is now being questioned a great deal. People are saying, well, actually, folk football survives well into the 19th century and definitely feeds into the great takeoff of what we regard as modern football towards the end of the century. The other thing that is being rethought is this idea that while the public schools civilized the wild folk game. Now, this just doesn't bear any scrutiny at all. As I've said, the folk game possibly wasn't as wild as people said. But also, you just have to read accounts of the public school game to realize that public school football was astonishingly violent and savage, far more so than the folk game.
So coming back to this moment in late October 1863, how big a milestone do you see that in the kind of development of football?
Well, it's not. This is my big point. It's a very important. It's a very important point moment in that the FA is established. But the 1863 rules, which are seen now almost as the Ten Commandments, you can get booklets printing them out. Those original 13 rules were pretty much never used. The key point about public schools is they were all fiercely jealous of each other. It wasn't just the rugby thing. All seven of the big old-fashioned public schools were fiercely jealous of each other, and they were not interested in getting a common code. They all wanted to stick to their own games. Now, various attempts had been made to develop a common code at Oxford and particularly Cambridge University, but if you actually look at them, they hadn't really been used. And the same happens in 1863. The rules that are developed in 1863 are pretty much never used. And just, just look at them. They bear no relation to modern football. They are also very obviously an attempt to compromise with rugby. They're sort of a mongrel version of the game, everybody's and nobody's, and that's how they were seen. And they were pretty much never used. Now, the really 1863, rather than being the sort of culmination of this progress, this process of civilizing and codifying football, it's the starting point. It's not the culmination, it's the starting point. What happens then is in the 1860s, you get adult clubs established in London. People like No Names of Kilburn, Dingley Dell, Wanderers, who are probably the best known. These are dominated by public schoolmen, but they're adults. They've moved away from their school days, and they realize that if they're going to continue playing football, they simply have to develop a common code. And that's where the real initiative comes for developing a common code. And in addition to that, and again, modern historiography focuses more and more on this. You have to look at the city of Sheffield. There's a great, simultaneously in the 1860s, there's a great takeoff of football in Sheffield. And there, what's very clear is the game is not being played by ex-public schoolmen. It's a game that's drawing very heavily on the old folk game. And Sheffield feeds very strongly into the evolution of the rules that then happens in the 1860s. So you get this sort of spontaneous evolution in Sheffield and in London, which happens throughout the 1860s. And really, in the space of a few years in the late 1860s, the modern rule book is developed. But to a degree, that happens entirely separate of the FA. It's clubs who are not even members of the FA evolving their own game. The FA then catches up with this process, and with the establishment of the FA Cup in 1871, at that point really does take control of football. And the story really begins from there.
How quickly did football become the mass spectator and mass participation sport that it is nowadays?
Pretty quickly. The FA Cup finals of the 1870s, if you'd gone along then, at that time they were teams of gentlemen amateurs, men who played for no pay, still playing a very, very physical game that we'd scarcely recognise as football. Although the modern rules have evolved, tactics have not, and they're still charging into each other and knocking each other over and all this sort of thing. There's almost nobody watching. They weren't terribly interested in spectatorism, as they called it. At that point, it is not a mass game by any means at all. 10 times as many people turned out to watch the Eton Harrow annual cricket game as turned out to watch the FA Cup final. What happens is in the early 1870s, you get a massive expansion of the Saturday half holiday for various reasons. You suddenly have this space for organised leisure for the working class outside of the Sabbath. It's problematic playing football on the Sabbath in the Victorian era because people are trying to stop you playing football on the Sabbath. And really, it's from that point, from the early 1870s, you begin to see the takeoff. It happens first in Glasgow and around, almost immediately afterwards in Lancashire, then you see it in the Black Country, then you see it in the Northeast. I mean, really, the period of takeoff of football, the takeoff in popularity, is when it begins to be played by the working classes. And that really begins to happen en masse from about 1880 onwards. And really, the great moment is 1883, when Blackburn Olympic become the first working class football team to win the FA Cup, defeating the Old Etonians in the final.
And so I suppose because of simple weight of numbers, eventually, once working class people did start playing football, they would come to dominate it in terms of both players and spectators.
Yes. I mean, if I'm to be rather sort of crude and blunt about this, I'd say at that point the upper classes decide to play rugby instead because they keep getting beaten, which is essentially what happens. And the working classes are inevitably going to dominate it because there are so many more of them. But what's interesting is that the working classes pick up threads that have already been developed by certain sort of middle class sides in the 1860s and 1870s. Firstly, the Sheffield teams, but also Queen's Park in Scotland, in Glasgow, formed in 1867, very important in the history of football. These are teams that are drawn very much from the respectable classes, but they're men who have not been to public school. They therefore come to the game fresh, develop their own tactics. The key thing these people do is they pass the ball to each other. It's called combination play. It's a great novelty in the 1870s. In the public school game, it was regarded as unmanly. It was an abdication of responsibility to pass the ball. It was all about, you know, charging into the other side. It was mock battle, essentially. It's these middle class teams that initially begin the habit of passing the ball to each other. And this is picked up by the new working class professionals, particularly in and around Glasgow, and developed further. Because it's the most efficient way of playing football, it's also important for men who are depending for their livelihood on football, which many working class players are by the late 1880s, it's very important to remain free of injury. So they're not particularly drawn to this charging physical game. Also, another key thing you have to remember, in the mid and late Victorian eras, the upper classes are much bigger than the working classes. Social class is very much reflected in the build of people. You can see the effect of environment and, above all, of diet. Upper class public school men tend to weigh a couple of stone and be 2 or 3 inches taller than working class men. And they can't compete in the charging game. So, you know, putting it very simply, they learn to pass the ball around upper class men. And really, the Invincibles, the Preston team of the 1880s, become the great model of the professional working class football team of the future.
And so is this physical discrepancy, is that why the working classes didn't really take to rugby in the same way that they took to football?
And they do to a degree, of course. Rugby is played, it is played among the working classes in Yorkshire and in South Lancashire, South Wales and parts of Scotland. But it's, you could debate forever why people choose to play football rather than rugby. My own feeling is that you really need to find an explanation for why some people would play rugby. And as I say, I think it becomes a public school game precisely because they are aware that they're losing control of football to the working classes.
So you're talking here about how the working classes became involved in football. When did football become a professionalised sport as opposed to an amateur sport?
That really, you begin to see that creeping in from the late 1870s. In Lancashire, Lancashire is the key area, Bolton, Blackburn, Preston, around there. It's beginning to become quite widespread in the early 1880s. The key thing that happens in football, and this is absolutely vital, 1885, you have this great crisis comes to a head over the issue of professionalism. You know, the gentlemen amateurs did not like the idea of playing football for a living. They thought it was unsporting and so on. Now, you can pick this apart psychologically. I mean, what is the problem of playing football for a living? You might argue that it's essentially because these people keep beating them. But anyway, it's a huge issue, and football divides over it. It's a very interesting thing because you can compare it with the same thing happens in cricket, the same thing happens in rugby. The great advantage football has is that because it comes from the great old public schools, it's dominated, the early FA is dominated by Eton and Harrow men who are really very upper class, and men who therefore have a certain self-confidence, a certain readiness to compromise, and basically, under certain conditions, they agree that professionalism will be legalized in 1885. And that is vital for the future of football. But because other sports don't manage that compromise. Rugby, as is well known, when the same thing happens in rugby in 1895, rugby splits. You get the split between rugby union and rugby league. Cricket, of course, develops this strange sort of feudal structure where the professional is almost sort of the servant of the gentleman amateur within the club. They have to bowl to them in the nets. They have to enter the field by a different gate. They even eat separately and so on. It's only football is very much ahead of the curve in British society in that it manages to overcome these sort of strange class obstacles and become a genuinely national sport.
And football also soon became an international sport. When did it start escaping the borders of England and Scotland and become played in other countries?
That begins to happen towards the end of the 19th century. Again, it's very much spread by British sailors, but also British administrators going around the world. And one of the odd things about football, of course, is it doesn't actually take off in the empire. It takes off in Latin America and Europe, but it's very much spread by the British. The British have really invented, in the late 19th century, the modern concept of sport. And this has a huge influence around the world. And a lot of early football clubs, we can still see it, you know, Athletic Bilbao, they take English names. The Corinthians in Brazil are set up in imitation of the English amateur team, the Corinthians. But really, it's the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, above all in continental Europe and the southern part of Latin America.
Now, people nowadays, always on TV and radio, complain that football's lost its soul, and they hark back to a time they say was a golden age of football. Now, you've studied the long history of football. Do you think that's a fair comparison, or were people always making this kind of complaint about the sport?
They've always made this kind of complaint. You get people writing this sort of thing in the early 1880s. People are absolutely outraged that people are earning £1 a game and that the sport has lost its soul, it's become a business, blah, blah. The same rhetoric you hear today, you've been hearing since the beginning of the 1880s. And then 20 years later, we're suddenly looking back on the present as a golden era. No, it's always gone on.
And do you watch football regularly yourself?
I do. I watch Spurs.
Would you rather watch Tottenham playing now in 2013, or would you rather go and watch a football game from 1863 if you had a time machine and you had the choice?
I'd rather watch the modern game. I mean, as I say, in fact, the 1863 game, there wasn't such a game. No one ever played it. But the mid-19th century game, it was incredibly crude and violent. It was a mock battle. There was no finesse to it. The game that was played, Eton and Harrow and so on, and you can still see it. I mean, they still play the field game and the wall game at Eton and Harrow, although the health and safety people have got their hands on it a bit now. But it's nothing like as entertaining as watching modern football. I mean, you know, football 20 years ago was nothing like as entertaining as modern football.
And do you think you'd get better pies now?
I think you probably would. The 1901 Cup Final was known as the Pie Final because Spurs played, I don't know if you know this, Spurs played away. They drew at Crystal Palace in front of a crowd of 113,000, the biggest that had ever turned out. You know, it's astonished contemporaries. They then played the replay in Bolton and the train company set the fares too high. And in Bolton, everyone got ready for another crowd of 100,000, and hardly anyone turned up. And they, in Bolton, they were left with something like 100,000 pies to eat.
That was Richard Sanders. His book, Beastly Fury, The Strange Birth of British Football, was published by Bantam Press in 2009. Last week, the BBC announced its plans for commemorating the First World War centenary, including some of its lead offerings for TV, radio and online. I headed over to the launch at New Broadcasting House, and after the announcements, I caught up with Martin Davidson, the BBC's commissioning editor for history, to get his perspective on the challenges the corporation faces in marking this major anniversary. I asked him first of all about how the BBC would balance competing national narratives of the conflict.
Our coverage will cover so many different stories, different approaches, yeah, and different angles that I don't believe it will be possible for any one angle to feel aggrieved. I think the non-British perspective does crop up in a number of our pieces, and although the role that the war played on Germany or the role that Germany, yeah, played in the war does crop up, I don't think it's something that we're certainly not jingoistic about or gratuitously warmongery about. The phrase I always use is, we're not glorifying anything, but what we are doing, to use that great phrase from the Wipers Times, who had a regular column, yeah, which was, people we take our hats off to, all we're doing is we're taking our hats off to as many of the 65 million men who put on uniform, as well as all their families who had to suffer the consequences, as possible. And part of taking our hats off to that generation is also to study and to interrogate and to understand better than ever before what they were fighting for.
And one concern, I think, is this just going to be, well, how can we prevent it being a lot of middle-aged white men talking to a lot of other middle-aged white men? Or is that a problem? Maybe that's not.
Well, no. The part of making the coverage last for 4 years across television, across radio, and in particular across online, part of the points of doing that is to make sure we draw as many different audiences as possible into the subject, yeah, matter, and we will be tailoring our output where and as appropriate to lots and lots of different audiences. This is absolutely not supposed to be simply for people who already know they're interested in World War I, although we will absolutely deliver those audiences with what we hope will be significant, substantial and original programming. But other audiences, not least people my kids' ages, I'm absolutely determined that they get something out of this too, that we make sure we tell a much wider range of stories than was possible 50 years ago when the BBC made The Great War. So there will be a major spotlight put on the experience of those 65 million men who put on uniform. Not all of them were white, not all of them were citizens of the European empires, those stories will feature much more centrally than we've ever done before. The stories of women, the stories of families, the stories of various home fronts, but also the geopolitics, the contribution that the First World War made to the world we live in today, to absolutely understand that process. So all of those are, I think, subjects and approaches that by no means speak only to one demographic.
I know you're primarily concerned with television, but there's going to be
World War One output throughout the BBC radio, yes. all the different TV channels online. Has it been a challenge to try and make sure there's not too much duplication and that all these things complement each other?
Definitely. No, we knew 18 months ago we started planning how to make sure that we maximised our output rather than gave anyone the excuse to not engage with our stuff because they thought it was over-duplicated. So we worked very, very hard to, if you like, make sure what we do complements and adds up to more than the sum of its parts because, yes, there is going to be a lot of output. But one of the most exciting things has been working very closely with radio and with nations and with local, both local radio and local television. Jane Ellison, Craig Henderson and I have been determined to do that right from the beginning. And make sure that our colleagues in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are part of that conversation too. So there will be a lot, but I remain confident you won't be looking at things thinking, wait a minute, this sounds very familiar, down even to the question of what archive we use. So one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm making sure production teams all speak to each other to make sure we don't all just use the same archive, because I think that is where the audience subliminally most notices possible duplication. So we're very mindful of that, and we're very determined that this whole thing, online radio television, adds up to more than the sum of its parts.
I know this is going to be also a difficult balance, but is there a danger of too much furthermore output? Have you tried to sort of do it so that it is not more than people actually can digest?
The calculation is a crucial one, and the way we've addressed that is to make sure my acid test is, would you have commissioned any of these pieces if there hadn't been an anniversary? Are they strong enough on their own? And my answer, I can put my hand on the heart, is everything I've been involved with, that is true. What they all have in common is these are films I would have been interested in commissioning anyway. What we're also going to do is use the advantage we have is that, of course, this is a centenary that lasts 4 years. So we don't all have to concentrate it into one very, very, very muddy patch of ground. That what we can do is, if you like, drop our major projects carefully into the schedule at key moments. So a combination of scheduling, a combination of making sure that our subject matter reinvents itself, and always making sure that we're commissioning pieces that we think have inherent value anyway, not just there to be stocking filler for an anniversary. Those are the three ways I think we're aiming to make sure that at the end of it, people will have had their pick from a well-furnished banquet, but won't feel stuffed.
Your brief encompasses more than just the First World War. You're in charge of all kinds of history on television. For those people who, for say, the First World War isn't their main interest, will there still be lots of other BBC history programmes on this period?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is not going to be... We commission history anyway, so it feels totally appropriate that some of what we're commissioning anyway should have World War One as its focus, but by no means exclusively all that we will be doing. There will be some of the other great subjects that we'll be looking at will include other anniversaries, not least World War Two anniversaries, but the extraordinary story of Magna Carta and the rise of British democracy as a result of that. We will be looking at there's a major bit of programming being planned around the early 17th century, around the time of the Mayflower and the Gunpowder Plot. We will be looking at periods very different from that of the first two decades of the 20th century.
That was Martin Davidson. To read more about the BBC's First World War plans, head to historyextra.com, where you'll also find interviews with Dan Snow and David Reynolds about the challenges of covering this anniversary. Well, that's almost all for this week. Do, as always, get in touch with your views on podcast@historyextra.com, and we'll do our best to read out some of your messages in future episodes. And as well as email, you can keep in touch with us on Twitter @HistoryExtra and Facebook, facebook.com/HistoryExtra. And don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find news, blogs, image galleries, quizzes and more. Next week, we'll be taking a trip around the National Maritime Museum's new Nelson Gallery and paying a visit to a haunted castle. Do join us for that, if you dare. The History Extra Weekly podcast was recorded in Bristol and produced by Jack Fletcher.